And Jesus himself said that he did not come to do away with the law.
This is the Adventist Pilgrimage Podcast with your hosts, Michael Campbell and Greg Howell.
Welcome back to the Adventist Pilgrimage Podcast with your hosts, Greg Howell and Michael Campbell. We're exploring a very important book that's just being released this spring, and I'm excited that we have the author here with us. Greg, tell us who the author is, what's the book, and what are we going to be talking about today?
Sure. Yeah, actually, this is kind of part two of a series that we've got going. So if you as a listener have not actually heard the first episode, I do invite you to come back to the February episode, and that kind of kicks off this whole discussion. But our guest is Dr. Denis Fortin. He's got a fantastic new biography out with the G.I. Butler
George
legacy.
Butler.
Mm-hmm. And that's all the general history of Butler kind of was in the last episode.
Let me make sure I get the subtitle. An honest but misunderstood leader, right?
That's right.
And okay. And if anything, this episode should explain why he's misunderstood. Because we're going to kind of focus in on this one. Into one of the big upsets in his leadership time during the 1888 Bible conferences.
Ooh, 1888. I know. I mean, that just starts getting the blood working, right?
If you really get into it, I mean, we've got a lot of people still very interested.
Passionate.
Very passionate about this particular moment in Adventist history.
Because we're dealing with theology, right?
It's theology, it's personality, it's leadership. It's legacy and inspiration. I mean, there's a lot going on.
A lot
of
stuff there.
So that's why we felt like this episode needs to be devoted
just to that saga.
Yeah, to this moment in Butler's career, but also in the wider church's existence, because there's a lot going on. So thank you for coming back with us today.
It's good, yes.
Super excited to hear where we go with this one.
Okay, let's give it a try.
Yeah, let's try it.
And let's start off. Go ahead.
Like with any good research project, 1888 has been covered from a lot of different angles. Lots of people have talked about it over the years, and still, you know, there's a lot of even entire organizations devoted to this 1888 message. Sometimes we call it that.
Well, Greg, we should probably back up for just a minute, because we're talking about 1888 already. There may be some listeners out there. I don't know. It might be kind of difficult, but there might be some listeners out there and saying, you know, hey, guys.
What is that?
What's this about?
What is it? So, yeah, let's back up and just... What happened? What is 1880 when we say that?
In a nutshell, what was it all about?
1888 is the moment when in October, November of that year, there is a general conference session of the Seventh-day Adventist Church that happens in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the only time that it is held there. Mm-hmm. It is the linchpin or the last event of a series of activities that have happened and discussions regarding how to understand the relationship between our faith in Jesus as our Savior, the righteousness we receive from Him, and the very important Seventh-day Adventist concept of obedience to the law of God. Do I need to keep the law in order to be saved? Or do I need to rely upon the righteousness of Christ to cleanse me and to give me salvation by grace through faith? And obedience would be, you know, the result or the fruit of that relationship with God. So in 1886 to about 1888, there's a lot of conversation in the Seventh-day Adventist Church through the periodicals of the church, the Battle Creek Review and Herald, the Oakland, California Signs of the Times, between all of them regarding how do you understand this subject? And it comes to a head in 1888 in Minneapolis. A huge confrontation. Really, it's conflictual. It is difficult. It is harsh. The personalities are really having a fight, so to speak. No physical fight, but a lot of arguments.
Matthew Lucio, in his Adventist History podcast, mm-hmm. I'll give him a little shout out here. He calls it the Adventist Civil War.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right.
I've never forgotten that.
No.
But it kind of, I think it actually, there's a truth to it, right?
There's a truth to it. Yes, there is. Yes.
Yeah.
So given the amount of material on this, and I know going through it in my own classes and stuff, there was a lot that you could read on this. Where, for your biography, did you find the best sources to kind of get into Butler's head behind some of what's going on here? Is there certain areas that seem the most informative for this, or what was your...
Again, you know, the theme of the biography has been, like we mentioned in the first episode, is to try to get into Butler's head, why he thinks the way he does, mm-hmm. and why he's acting the way he does, why does he say right what he does. And yes, there's a lot of information about 1888, lots of interpretation of 1888, but what I thought had not been really delved into adequately were his own writing about 1888. Mm-hmm. So these would be letters that he wrote around 1888, from 1886, 85, 86, until 1889, mm-hmm. and then again in the early 1900s. There are a number of letters that he wrote within the conflict, as part of the conflict, but also reflecting later about the conflict. Mm. And that's where I think the greatest insights came to me about his relationship to 1888, where we may have really misunderstood him by not understanding what he said and why he said what he said.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's where we'll go.
Fantastic. That's what I want to know. Because to me, yeah, like you said, there's outside interpretation, but then there's the person inside of that who's
that's
doing
right.
it. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly, great. Exactly.
Well, let's just dive in.
Yeah.
At this point in Butler's...
Where do we begin?
Yeah. Well, at this point in Butler's life, if you're looking at 86 to 88, who is he, what he's doing, what is he doing, and why is this on his table?
Well, in 1886, he's the General Conference president, has been since the summer of 1880. Mm. And as the General Conference president, in the footsteps of James White, he understands himself as being the leader of the church, but leader in the sense of protector as well, to make sure that the heritage of the church is not tampered with, and that it is people are being faithful to it, and that Adventism is, you know, being cared for. So in the form of a shepherd, in the form of a protector, arbiter perhaps as well, but also ultimately in the footsteps of James White, the one who makes the decisions. Mm-hmm. Okay, that will change later.
Yeah.
But with Butler following James White, the GC president makes the decisions. And supposedly, people should defer to him.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the mood with James White.
So there's definitely a, kind of a, like a leadership model here.
Yes, there is. That's another thing we could talk about.
Yeah. Well, and let me clarify. Makes the decisions administratively or theologically?
Like both.
Where he sees them as both.
A little bit of both.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
At least to defer to his opinion.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That if the leader makes a decision, you should defer to that. You know, the mood had been, while James White was General Conference president, that even though you didn't agree with him, you would defer to him for the sake of peace and the sake of harmony and at least a semblance of it.
Interesting.
And so he becomes General Conference president in the 1880s during his second term, and will come to the presidency with that in mind.
Interesting.
So that's what's important to understand.
I love you bring that up, because even in some of my own research in the 1880s and 90s, you look at America and it's the time of the magnates, you know, the steel,
yes.
the steel industry and the men behind it. Yes. They are leading it. And, you know, they look at it as a monopoly.
Yeah.
And so as much
they're
as I want
to charge.
Yeah. And as much as I want to be like, Butler, come on, that's a little heavy handed. You're taking on too much authority. In his own culture and time frame, American industry was that.
Yeah,
and so it's accepted.
It's accepted, and it's almost expected. Yeah.
The presidency of the United States is like this as well.
Yeah,
Ulysses Grant,
right?
Is a good example.
Grant, even Teddy Roosevelt later. I mean,
that's right.
This is their era, right? Yeah. So we have to see him in that.
It's the era of the hero worship.
Exactly. Mm.
Kind of. Yeah.
Okay.
The story of 1888 begins in the kitchen of the Butler home in Waterbury, Vermont, in 1850. Okay, we're going back a long time here.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Joseph Bates knows that the Ezra Pitt Butler family is a Millerite family. They are very discouraged because Jesus has not come again. Mm-hmm. So Butler goes to visit that home.
Mm-hmm. Bates.
Bates.
Yeah, yeah.
Bates goes to visit the Butler home in Waterbury, Vermont. George Butler is a teenager, a small boy, teenage boy there in those years. And Bates arrives, pulls out his chart, puts it on the wall, begins to explain the prophecies of Daniel and Revelation, the role of the law of God and the Sabbath and the plan of salvation for the people who are awaiting the second coming of Jesus. Sarah Butler, the mother, listens to him, becomes a Sabbatarian.
Yeah.
that afternoon or that evening. Ezra Pitt Butler holds back for about a year or so, and then also becomes a Sabbatarian Adventist. What is it that will convince Sarah Butler and Ezra Pitt Butler, so the parents of George Butler, to become from Baptist to Sabbatarian Advent? What is the arguments that Joseph Bates is using to convince them?
I love this part. This is
that's crucial to understand 1888.
Yes.
But Bates says there is a difference in the Old Testament between the moral, eternal, immutable law of God of the Ten Commandments and all of the other laws of the book of Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and whatever. So those are ceremonial law, temporary laws, cultural laws, whatever they may be. So different kinds of laws, but temporary. But when it comes to the Ten Commandments, that is immutable. So there is a distinction between the law of God and the ceremonial law of God. Mm-hmm. One is eternal, one is done away with at the cross. That argument changes Ezra Pitt's Butler understanding of the relationship of obedience and in the plan of salvation, and helps him from Baptist to become Sabbatarian Adventist.
Okay.
And George Butler, although he's a teenager, agnostic, infidel to some extent, you know, wanting to stand back a little bit from all the fanaticism of the Millerite movement and early Sabbatarians, is listening to the conversation. And when he becomes a Sabbatarian Adventist, it is because he accepts his father's and mother's and Joseph Bates' understanding of the relationship between eternal law, ceremonial law. So when in the 1850s, 54 to 57, Sabbatarian Adventists begin to discuss between themselves the relationship of the word law in the writings of Paul.
Right.
They begin to discuss that again.
Yeah.
Is Paul in the book of Galatians that the law has served as a tutor, some kind of a mediator until, you know, some it went away? What is that law that Paul is referring to in the epistle to the Galatians, chapter 3, verse 24? What law is that? Well, some are, you know, of perhaps of the Baptist kind. They will say all the laws, everything is law. And so everything is given away. Oh, wait a moment there. If everything is given away, what do you do with the Sabbath? Is that also ceremonial law? But there are others who are really convinced by Joseph Bates' argument. No, there's a distinction between the two. And what the law refers to in Galatians 3:24 is the ceremonial law. Those were nailed at the cross, and those were temporary, given through a mediator like Moses by the angels and so on. Allusion to Mount Sinai. And so on. So that argument therefore wins. So from 1857 or so until the mid-1880s, that is the dominant understanding of the relationship between moral law, ceremonial law in Adventism. So you got all of the pastors, almost all, not all, but almost all of the pastors, evangelists in the Sabbatarian Adventist concept, the early Seventh-day Adventists, who will argue to death with Baptists and Methodists and other pastors about the distinction between the two laws in order to be able to claim that the Sabbath was never abolished. Mm-hmm. It is not a ceremonial law. It is the eternal law of God. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the 1860s, 1870s, there's a lot of debates between Sabbatarian Adventists and other denominations.
Bates himself is doing it. He's traveling
Bates
all over.
Bates is doing it. Yeah. Butler is doing it. Yeah. Ken Wright, Bordeaux, Loughborough, you know, Haskell's, they're all doing it. They're all having these arguments with the pastors about the denominations.
That's a pillar theological thing.
It is a pillar of Seventh-day Adventist theology. There is a distinction between the laws of the Old Testament.
And apologetic.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very apologetic.
Yeah.
People converted to Adventism because of this distinction.
Because of that distinction. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why is it that so many Methodists and Baptists become Seventh-day Adventists? It's because of that distinction.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, there's one person among the pioneers who never accepted it, or never accepted that point of view. And his name is Joseph Wagner. He is the father of E.J. Wagner. Mm-hmm. and he's the editor of the Signs of the Times in Oakland, California. And he begins to write articles, along with his son, E.J. Ellett Wagoner, begin to write articles that purport to say that when Paul talks about law in Galatians, he means everything. He means the Old Testament. So what was done away as a tutor at the cross is all the laws, meaning therefore that we cannot be saved by what we obey, but only by the grace of God. And when those articles begin to be published in 1886 in the Signs of the Times, you got George Butler in Battle Creek with Uriah Smith, the general editor of the Review and Herald in Battle Creek, who begin to have heartaches.
I was going to say they have a conniption.
they have a conniption fit. They have a conniption fit because for Butler and Uriah Smith, that is a pillar of Adventism that is being undermined.
Yeah. It's like they're questioning Adventist orthodoxy.
They are. That distinction for them is fundamental. You cannot tamper with that. And therefore, you cannot stand before Baptist and Methodist pastors to claim that the Sabbath is eternal if you argue that way about the law in Galatians.
Yeah. Sure. Now, to bring you back to what you said there, that's fascinating because to say the law is eternal, but it also is your keeping of the law is an element of your eternal salvation. That's an extra little step, you know, because even today we would say God's law is timeless, you know.
Yeah.
Thou shalt not kill should always be part of,
that's,
you know.
Right.
But to attach it to your salvation, now that's the part that seems like it's a pin to change things on.
Yeah.
So is Wagner saying it's not a part of your salvation?
Well, he says it is a fruit of our salvation.
Okay.
We will keep the Sabbath. The Sabbath is eternal for sure. I mean, Wagner is not challenging that. But it says, but when it comes to the interpretation of the law in Galatians, he claims that Paul refers to all the commandments of the Old Testament.
Okay, all right.
And for Butler and Smith, that's a no-no. You can't do that. And you can't, if you do that, therefore you undermine the entire history of Adventism, the theology of Adventism.
Mm-hmm.
So the debate therefore begins in 1886. Butler asks Ellen White, please, would you help us figure this out? You were with us in the early years of Adventism, even before we were organized as a church, and we began to have these discussions. And we remember you writing something, a testimony or something, claiming that there's a distinction between the two. And would you please, you know, confirm that, dig up the testimony and let us know what it says and confirm that for us.
Basically, Ellen White, please solve our problem.
Ellen White, please solve our problems. Now, we must admit the one thing which is not admitted very often is that Ellen White looks for the testimony.
She does.
Like I say, she tries.
But can't find it, right? I mean, that's
she looks for it.
Yeah.
So she goes along with, could you solve the problem?
Right. Initially.
Initially.
Yeah.
But then she can't find it for whatever reason. She can't find it. Yeah. In fact, we don't have it either.
Still don't.
We still don't. She cannot find it. And then so she backs off. And she says, well, in any case, I should not be the one figuring out what we all believe. You study your scripture, and you come to your own decision. And that's okay. That's what God wants it. Let not me be the arbiter of what truth is.
Hmm. In fact, I think she frames it as in God's providence that she couldn't find it. Right?
Yeah, she does. Yeah. Ultimately, that's what she's going to say. Ultimately, that's in God's providence. So here we go. Smith and Butler, though, they're convinced that she's copping out. She's not being faithful.
She's not taking on her role.
She's not taking on her role.
Yeah.
She is. Well, why is it that all of a sudden she's got this this memory lapse? And for them that no, come on. They're a little upset that by the fact that she's not coming through. So Butler decides, well, since these guys have written all of these articles in 1886 in the Oakland, California Signs of the Times, Butler says, well, because he finds that that is his role as the pastor of the church to be able to present a fair explanation of the theology of the church. So he prepares a little booklet, 100 pages or so, I think, on the law in Galatians. And he has a few, about 100 copies printed, distributed only to the members of the church who are attending the GC session in 1886.
Okay.
The one in Battle Creek, 1886. And only the delegates receive it. So it's not sold at large to the church.
Canvassers aren't doing it door-to-door.
No, it's not going to be sold. It's only for the delegates.
These are the key church leaders of our denomination.
That's right. The key church leaders, conference presidents, and a few other leaders that are there. So he gives it to them. And he explains to the best of his abilities that entire theology of the distinction between the two. That is very important to him. So if you really want to understand George Butler's perspective and early Adventist theology coming out of Joseph Bates, John Andrews, and the others, it is that book of Butler.
Now, I've read that very carefully, and one of my takeaways is not only is he explaining it, he's also a bit defensive, like, of course I believe in righteousness by faith, you know? And so this is kind of, you know, by the way, don't think I don't believe this, but this is the view of the church.
That's true. That's another point. Thank you for bringing this up. You know, George Butler and his family heritage is Baptist.
Right.
Okay, they're Baptist. They believe in justification by faith and not salvation by works. I mean, that's core to their, you know, spiritual heritage.
I'm kind of reading between the lines. It almost feels like he's insulted that anyone would ever question that.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. He's insulted by that. Well, and we'll come back to that.
Okay.
That's
sorry, I don't want to get ahead of you.
No, but that's an important point. Yeah. If not in this podcast, in the next one.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that. So he does that, prints this little booklet, distributes it to everybody, and then something happens. You see, Ellen White had said earlier in 1886, that Jones and Wagoner in Oakland should not have gone ahead and introduced all of this subject to create conflict in the church. She says to them that they should have deferred to Smith and to Butler and not become an irritant when theology comes along. Well, Butler finds that this is marvelous. Ellen White is agreeing with him, and he takes that to be the go-ahead to print that little book. But after he prints the little book, Ellen White, I would say perhaps backs off a little bit, and she says, well, you went ahead and you printed that little book for them, then we should give them, Jones and Wagoner, perhaps the occasion to present their case and prepare a little book as well. And that completely infuriates Butler. He says, no, that's not how it works. They are the ones who started this difficult situation by printing their articles in the Signs of the Times.
They've already said what they needed to
say. what they needed to say. I printed my little booklet only and to only give it to some delegates to balance the conversation, so that then we could make some enlightened decisions regarding this topic. So Butler begins to be very upset here in some ways about what's happening, given what is happening, given the role here and the back and forth that seems to be happening in Ellen White's mind when it comes to Jones and Wagoner and Butler and Smith. And she tells both camps, you know, just sit down together, discuss the issues, come to some agreement, but don't create these kinds of controversies. But it does not happen that way.
Sure.
By the time 2 years go by, because by then the GC session is every 2 years, we get to Minneapolis in 1888. And Ellen White, through William White, her son, is encouraging that the delegates who come should come a couple weeks earlier to the GC session and have an institute, a Bible institute.
So kind of like a training.
Like a training, in-service training for pastors and presidents of conferences who will be there. Let's discuss a number of topics, education, let's Sabbath school, let's talk about prophecies, and let's talk about the law, righteousness by faith, and all of this. And Butler feels, it's a feeling at first, really, oh, there is something going on there. Why is William White wanting this to happen and giving some kind of a tribune to or a podium to Jones and Wagoner. That should not be happening this way. And
is this being him being overbearing or just not wanting to make this a divisive issue?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
A little bit of both. Overbearing, yes. but not wanting the divisive issue because it will be divisive.
And he knows that, yeah.
He knows that. Everybody knows that.
Yeah, yeah.
That if they're going to discuss that topic at Minneapolis, they are going to have a fight.
Mm. Yeah, sure.
They're going to. And he does not want that to happen, Butler. But by then, Butler has been suffering from a progressive burnout for 3 years. Mm-hmm. It started in 1886. He's so worked out over what's happening, this discussion about the law that is damaging Adventist theology at the very core, that his mental health begins to suffer.
Yeah, yeah.
And for the months of the summer of 1886, he goes to a cabin not too far from Kalamazoo on Gull Lake. It's a resort kind of place. He has a tent and stays there for a few weeks, to try to recoup. He regains his health a little bit, but then the GC session of 1886 happens. Then the next summer of 1887, burnout again. He's so worked out by all of this. He finds that to be such a mental burden on him, spiritual burden also at the same time, that he's out again for about 4 months. By the time we get to the summer of 1888, now that is real burnout.
Yeah.
It has been accumulating, and he's never got over it.
So he's kind of in this cycling downward spiral, you might say, I guess.
Yes, and that's what's happening mentally. That's what's happening to him.
Yeah.
Mm. And he finds that Ellen White is not supporting him.
Okay.
And that she's giving too much credence to Jones and Wagoner. Mm-hmm. William White seems to be in that camp as well. Well, he lives in California, after all.
He's the son of a prophet.
He's the son of her.
And we know what Californians are like. So
all right, we're pointing at you, Greg.
I know, but I'm a born and bred Ohioan, so I don't feel right. California yet.
And so what's happening is that, you know, Butler and Smith and a few others begin to believe that this is a conspiracy arising out of California. Mm. They're going to come to this institute in Minneapolis. They're going to try to impose their points of view. And
the trust levels are pretty low right now.
Trust levels are very, very low. Mm. And Butler is completely burned out.
Yeah. One more interesting dynamic. We haven't talked about it, but in the same time period, we have D.M. Kenwright, who's exiting the church, right? I mean, so here he is dealing with apostasy, right? And so here we have kind of in the 1880s is this kind of downward spiral of Kenwright, although he actually leaves Adventism. And that's probably also, I'm guessing, so there's a number of different factors that are kind of raising the blood pressure, so to speak, you know, those anxiety levels that are going on. Would you say that's fair to say?
Very fair, and I'm glad you bring this up.
Yeah.
In 1886, at this general conference session, after the little booklet of Butler has been distributed, a committee is established, an even committee of about eight people, four on the Jones and Wagoner side, four on the Smith-Butler side. Kenwright is part of that committee. In that subcommittee, they discussed this issue hours and hours and hours to try to bring a recommendation to the floor on what is going to be the Adventist position on the law in Galatians. And the committee simply says they can't agree, four against four. Kenwright is with Butler and Smith because he's been arguing that point of view to apologetically in his debates.
Yeah.
And they simply make a recommendation of being kind toward and one another, to not make this a point of contention, that people continue to study. That's what it is. But out of that committee, Kenwright comes out of the committee and says, we've been wrong all along on the law and on the Sabbath, because he is won over by Wagoner, but he does one more step than Wagoner. If the law is not necessary to be saved, then it's not necessary to keep it either. And that is the linchpin that will lead Kenwright to leave the church 2 months later.
So Kenwright's a victim of this discussion, in a way.
Kenwright is a victim. I mean, it's the last straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak, in Kenwright's relationship with the church. And he will leave the church officially February of 1887. So just a couple months after the GC session.
Poor Butler just can't catch a break with with controversy and apostasy, can he?
That's right. And Ken Wright, to him, to Butler and Smith, there you go.
Proof
that this theology arising out of Jones and Wagoner is damaging the church.
Yeah.
Ken Wright is one of the first victims of this theology. So, I mean, the stakes are high here, very, very high.
Theological subcommittees, like stalemate?
I can't imagine committees not being able to solve the problems of the church.
Come on.
I say that a little ironically for those that are listening, you know, but a little tongue-in-cheek that, you know, but yeah, there's a human element in these debates and discussions, right? And there are very real casualties along the way.
Yeah, there are.
And for Butler, like you said, this isn't just a theological issue. It's not even just, you know, theoretical in his mind. It's why he even came back to Christianity in a way.
That's right.
Those early Bates conversations.
It's an identity issue.
It's an identity. Because Bates's whole, like, sealing in the sanctuary and all of that stuff from the Sabbath was God's seal of identity.
That's right.
And it becomes something that Butler hangs everything on.
That's right.
And that's so fascinating.
I mean, that's Butler's identity.
Yeah.
If you undermine that point of theology, you undermine why he is a Seventh-day Adventist.
Exactly.
Why his father and mother became Seventh-day Adventist. Why his entire family is Seventh-day Adventist. And it undermines all of that. And so, and proof is Ken Wright leaving the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we really are dealing with an Adventist existential crisis.
Very much existential. So we get to 1888, and by then Butler is really, really, really sick. Hmm. And he sends message that he should not be reelected as GC president. He does not want to. He really needs to take a break. Hmm. And then finally, they will accept the point of view, his point of view. They will elect Olson, Pastor Olson, who is a missionary at the time in Norway, in Scandinavia. And he will become the GC president. In the interim, Willie White will become the GC president.
In fact, they ask him multiple times. In fact, I was in the GC archives, and by accident, an anonymous folder found a couple of those Butler letters. And I know one of those was reflecting at the very end of his life. Talk about sources, right? How they did, in fact, and we have now this documented in this letter where they kept asking him, and he was turning it down. So it wasn't just, and again, talk about historiography, where it's almost this narrative, he was on the wrong side, so they booted him out of the general conference session, but that wasn't the case, right?
No, they did not boot him out. He needed to get out. He knew he needed to get out if he wanted to stay alive.
But they were still asking.
But they were still asking.
And Ellen White supported.
And just like they asked James White all the time to be reelected general conference president, even though he was fairly sick.
So back to this leadership milieu.
It's the leadership mind. I mean, the leaders are the leaders until they die. A little bit like a papacy.
Okay. Oh, now we're going on to meddling now. So.
Well, the other side is, honestly, I feel like the position's got a bit of a bad track record in burning people out. So maybe there's a
maybe it was not the healthiest model of leadership. mercy.
Well, he's not reelected, and he moves to Florida in the December of 1888, and he will stay there for many, many, many years in leadership. So, but to come back to Butler and to continue with him and his relationship to 1888 and the situation there. After 1888, Ellen White will go on a camp meeting trail or a church meeting trail with Jones and Wagoner and will promote their points of view, will support them. Not totally agreeing with every points of view they present. I mean, it's obvious from her writings that even the little book Steps to Christ, a number of things in that little book that do not agree with Wagoner's understanding of law and salvation, a little book that comes out in 1892. Be that as it may, she loves the emphasis on righteousness by faith, uplifting Christ, being less legalistic in Adventism and more salvation-oriented, more justification-oriented. But Butler, you know, goes incognito, just leaves basically all leadership. He goes to his retreat in Florida to recoup. As I've said in the first episode, his wife gets very sick from stroke and will therefore take care of her for many, many, many years. In 1893, so 5 years later, after 1888. Haskell begins a conversation with Butler by correspondence, by letters, in which Haskell says, "But you know, Brother Butler George, some good benefits have come out of this concept of righteousness by faith and emphasizing Jesus as our Savior in Adventism. You know, we were very legalistic and we needed to talk about Jesus. And it's done some very good things in our church." Haskell does his best to show that to Butler. And after being out of the fray for so many years, Butler responds, "Well, I think you got a point. I think you're right." And so Butler, in I think it is in May of 1893, June 13, 18. I'm looking at my sources.
All right, here, back to sources.
he writes a short article. Yeah. It's titled "Personal," June 13, 1893, the Review and Herald. And it is basically a confession, quotation mark confession. Confession that he realizes that the message of Wagner, after all, has been a blessing to the church. It is not a confession that he has been wrong.
Yes.
In understanding the matter, the theological matter.
He's not conceding.
He is not conceding being theologically wrong. He is conceding being too nasty about it and being too strong, being too opinionated, being too opposed to this beautiful message, and that the Lord needed to get him out of the way.
Now,
That's
unpacking
still huge.
That for a little bit because, you know.
Unpack that.
Yeah, because, you know, here from that leadership model he had come from, that's quite a concession.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But 5 years later, you know, pulled back, he's reading the beautiful reports in the Review because he keeps receiving the Review. About, you know, what's happening in the world, that the Lord is blessing the church. People are talking about Jesus. Well, he's a Baptist heritage. Of course you talk about Jesus. And he sees that. Haskell, you know, nudges him to see that. And then he admits it.
So it really is a significant concession.
Because it's not a theological one. It's a practical looking backwards.
Pragmatic.
This message didn't.
The spiritual.
Yeah, this message didn't blow up the church.
No, it didn't.
It didn't destroy what I...
He thought it would happen.
It would. Exactly.
He was afraid it would destroy the church.
So therefore, it must not have been as bad as I thought.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And there's also probably a personal level where he's, like you mentioned, out of the fray. So he's able to actually take that break that he had needed maybe.
Yes.
And there's a certain element
of... Too close to the fight.
Yeah.
To see what's really happening.
To step back and have a time of personal and physical and spiritual renewal.
That's right. And that's what happened.
If you're at that level of burnout, which it sounds like he was. You are not dealing with conflict well.
No.
You're also at a state...
You're part of the conflict.
Yeah. And you're also
making it worse.
You're not dealing with things theologically neutral because your life feels like it's on the line.
That's right.
And so everything seems like it's a life issue, life or death, right?
Yeah.
So you got to take that into account for his reaction.
And that's what happened, I think. And I think we've not been gracious to take that into account in his reaction. But perhaps just to close the story here on 1888, okay, what about the future? What about the rest of his life? Well, we do know from historical evidence, letters that he wrote in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. So we're now a good 12, 15 years after 1888.
Mm-hmm.
We do know in writing that he still held the same positions on the law in Galatians, the two kinds of laws. He never abdicated that.
Wow.
He never gave that point of view away.
Props to him for being consistent.
Very consistent. We have also evidence from a couple letters of Arias Smith before he died. I think Smith dies in 1905, in which Smith also admits that he has never changed his point of view on the law in Galatians. They just agreed to disagree and to be a little kinder about the whole issues.
Wow. Like a truce.
Yeah.
Okay. Spiritual truce. Yeah. Of some. That's what happens. So to his, as far as I can tell, to his dying days, Butler never changed his mind when it came to this theological point of Adventism. Never changed his mind. He agreed that Some good came out of it, but as far as theology is concerned, he still believed it was all wrong.
How could he not, though? That's why he came back from his infidel years,
yes,
right?
That's right. And that's how his father and mother became Sabbatarian Adventists. So to change his mind on that would simply say his parents had been wrong.
And thereby him.
And therefore him as well.
Yeah.
That destroys his entire Adventist theology, mm-hmm. is completely losing its foundation. Mm-hmm. And he would be, therefore, why be an Adventist?
Well, one of the things I love here at the end, and I love the consistency and everything else, and when I have taught this over the years, you know, in terms of a class, you know, is Wagner and Jones here bring this spiritual renewal and everything else, and they usually are the heroes of the story, right?
Yes.
And when it's presented like that. But what I love is there is a little bit of irony, because those who have studied the whole 1888 saga, Jones and Wagner actually end up, quote-unquote, losing their way. I mean, that's a whole separate story.
Yep.
But you have to admire the fact that he kind of sticks with it. I mean, he sticks with the church, even though he can't understand or reconcile it. And at the end, after Lentha passes away, he still goes on and serves the church. And there's a deep
for many years.
Loyalty and commitment to the church, to Ellen White, and despite maybe not, and maybe there's some hope for all of us that we may not have everything theologically figured out, but yet you have to admire that consistency and commitment all the way to the very end. And that's part of the irony, I think, of 1888 is he kind of stays with it even after, you know, Canwright kind of bites the dust and Jones and Wagner kind of go off in a different tangent. But there he is.
And is Kellogg in all of this,
and Kellogg too?
Yeah.
So there is a bit of irony here at the very end of his story.
That's right, yeah. A faithful man, honest, faithful, integrity, true to his convictions, theological, spiritual convictions, true to his heritage, family, church heritage. In that sense, a good man. A good example. Yeah, rugged, you know, stubborn, sure.
He lived with the Indians for a while. He was willing to chart his own trail.
I still hope we find that picture.
Yeah, that's right. You know, sure, but nonetheless.
Yeah. You know. So tell us really quick, before we wrap up this episode, where can someone find this book? Who's published it? Where do you find it?
It's published by Pacific Press, like any of the other Adventist Pioneer book biography series. Mm-hmm. It will be available on Amazon, I'm pretty sure. Mm-hmm. Any other platforms that sell books.
Adventist Book Center.
Adventist Book Center, ABCs, that's right.
Camp Meetings.
Camp Meetings will have it this coming summer, 2024 summer.
Great.
Yes.
Well, can't wait for that to be released.
It will be a good book to read. I hope so.
No, I highly recommend it. I actually have gotten a sneak preview of both of us have. And if you love Adventist history, this is a must read.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thanks again, Dr. Fortin. We want to thank you, our listeners, for going through our second of our three-part series here on Butler. Thanks for coming out. And again, if you have thoughts, questions, ideas, do check us out on all the social media outlets and accounts. We are under the Adventist Pilgrimage Podcast, part of the larger Adventist History Network. So thanks again for listening.
And Jesus himself said that he did not come to do away with the law.
Take us out of this world if he does not want us to be contaminated by